something that didn't happen. Chapter 1, Crossing Over. After this I looked, and there before me was a door standing open in heaven. Revelations 4 and 1. Just as I crossed the tracks, I saw a ghost. There he was, standing on the corner of the ragtag house where he had lived with his mother. There he was, looking like a ghost of the boy we used to call Ghost. He was still tall and lanky, but that day he looked sickly thin, his dark skin ashy, his eyes bloodshot and blank. His shirt was part in and part out of his pants. By the look of his pants, he had just peed on himself. His walk was a shaking that moved into a stumble. Memory of that years ago day wouldn't leave me. I remembered how that day I couldn't bring myself to get out of my car and talk with Ghost. I couldn't even get myself to pull up alongside of him and say hello. Seeing the wet front of his pants made me remember us in elementary school. Ghost used to pee on himself then. I remembered how sad he would look when it happened. I remembered how he used to say to me, "Robert, for true I don't know what happens." Now today, still with that memory, I was driving over the same tracks I had crossed when I last saw Ghost. Earl and Ghost had lived in the same part of town, not more than 4 blocks from each other. They had never been friends. Got along only to be with the rest of our group when we were 6. I drove past Ghost's corner. It was empty now. No ragtag house or little hole-in-the-wall nightclub. And Ghost was dead. I went past that corner and turned left on Abe Lincoln, and then took a right. I was trying to find Second Lane where Earl lived with his aunt when we were at Holy Ghost. Now he lived there alone. I found the address. I got out of my car. I didn't know what to expect. My chest was tight. I was holding both hands in hard fists. If anyone saw me, they must have thought I had come for a fight. I was going into a hard place. The time had come. I knocked. The door opened, and there was Earl. "Beware the eyes of September, Robert." After 35 years, those were Earl's first words to me, as we stood in the doorway of his house looking at each other. Then he stepped aside. Only with the gesture of his arm and hand, he told me to come in. Earl was still soothsayer, it seemed. In no way did that thought relax me. Without saying anything else to me, Earl closed the door, walked across the room, and sat down. I sat across from him on the couch. Air in the room was heavy and stale. Windows of that living room were covered with dark tapestries. "He's on his way." "Who's on his way?" "Dolores' son." "What? Why is he coming here now?" "Because I called him and told him you would be here today." "Earl, soothsayer." "Earl, Robert." "Call me soothsayer." "Damn, Earl. All right, okay. Soothsayer." "Why did you call him?" "You didn't know I was coming. Nobody knew. So why did you call him?" Earl, soothsayer, just sat there looking at me. There was almost a smile on his face. Almost. His expression seemed to be his answer. And his answer seemed to be, "You already know why." "Don't get mysterious on me already, soothsayer." He got up and went into what must have been the kitchen. I heard cubes of ice hitting glass and the tap water running. His living room was small. I was sitting on a white couch. The cloth was hand-woven with an almost sack-like feel. The armrests were hand-carved wood. Where soothsayer had sat, when I first came in, was a big chair that had the same material as the couch, same hand-carved armrest. Under the covered window to the right of the couch, there was a rocking chair so wide and its back so tall that even I could sit in it comfortably. Like me, Earl, soothsayer, lived by himself, but nothing was similar. Just inside the front door, under the window to the left of the couch, was a bookshelf, with nothing but books on the metaphysical. I had a chess set. Soothsayer had a Ouija board. He came back into his small living room, handed me a glass of water, then sat back down in his chair. He picked up a book, put on his glasses, and started to read. Soothsayer! He looked up at me. He seemed to expect me to say something more. What are you doing? I asked. Waiting. Waiting for what? Waiting for him. For who? Dolores' son. I told you he would be here soon. I could feel myself leaning forward, staring at Soothsayer. My hands were once again balled into fists. Now I really did feel like I was going into battle. Soothsayer took his glasses off, put his book aside. How have you been all these years, Robert? I had to calm down before I answered. I reclined into the couch and leaned my head back, resting. In some ways, my life is so good it's unbelievable. I am successful, a college teacher, a professor of all things, Soothsayer. Respected, finally financially comfortable, active in my church, called to the ministry. It does sound like a good life, Robert. Yeah, but sometimes, Soothsayer, sometimes. Sometimes what, Robert? Sometimes I don't feel right. I feel like there's something unsettled. That's why I called him and told him you would be here today. When, Soothsayer, when did you call him? The day I called your mother and asked her to speak with you. That was 3 weeks ago. 3 weeks ago, I didn't know I was coming. When I lifted my head to look at Soothsayer, he had that almost smile on his face again. Chapter 2. Coming Home. Opelousas, Louisiana is a small bayou town. Usually when a car pulls up in front of your house, you know the car and the person driving it. Mama had been sitting on the porch when I slowly drove up in the rental car and parked. I could see Mama lean forward to try to look in the car. The car I was driving was unfamiliar, so she told me later Mama was wondering, who is that coming to my house? I got out and walked to the front of the car and opened the hurricane fence gate into our yard. Mama stood up with this puzzled look on her face and came forward. Oh, Robert, she said. Robert, you're home, chef. Hey, Mama, how you doing? As I got to the top of the three steps and onto the porch where she could reach me, Mama hit me in my chest, first with her left palm, then with her right, and then repeating until I pulled her into my arms. Robert, why didn't you tell us you were coming home? As usual, Mama was fussing, smiling, crying, hugging me, and calling Daddy all at the same time. Ogis! Ogis! Look who's home! How you doing, Professor? Hey, old man. I walked over and gave Daddy a big bear hug. I think he had finally gotten used to the fact that I had turned out to be what Mama called a hugging man. Mama was in the kitchen now. She had sent Daddy out to get some fresh crawfish tails to make an etouffee. I wanted to tell her that I could just eat a sandwich, but I knew better than to put my life in danger that way. I stood on the porch now, watching the drizzle, smelling the dust rise up off the ground, the grass, and the leaves of the trees. Looking out on Melanson Street and the neighborhood, off to my right, I could see up the street to the corner where Mr. Mack's little store used to be. We used to go there to get a loaf of bread or a can of this or that for Mama. And when we had enough money, we were allowed to go there to buy cookies and candy. Back then, it didn't take much money. I remember that 10 cents was enough to get a nice little bag of goodies. 2 pieces of hard candy for a penny, a couple of cookies for 2 cents, and 2 small Tootsie Rolls for a nickel. And I would have treats for the whole afternoon. This day, As I stood on our porch looking toward Mr. Mack's corner store, I saw a man coming up the street carrying a plank. He didn't seem bothered by the drizzle of rain that shined off his dark skin. He even slowed down as he got near our house. He was looking at me. He stopped. He called out to me. "Robert, are you?" "Yeah, it's me." "Robert, where you been like that, you?" "I live in North Carolina now." "North Carolina? That's a long way from here. You like it up there?" "Well, it's not home, but it makes do. How long are you home for this time?" "Not long. 3 or 4 days." "North Carolina. Well, you take care up there, you." "I will. You be good down here. Ça tous les mêmes choses, Robert. You know. It's all the same." He was making his way up Melanson Street again, carrying his plank to some destination. I didn't really know who he was. I thought he might be June, Dice's brother. I didn't really know. But I knew better than to insult him by asking. Right then, I decided to stretch my legs and take my usual back-at-home walk around the neighborhood. The drizzle was light, and I'd always liked walking in the rain anyway. I stuck my head in the house and told Mama I was going for a walk. "Go on, Sha. We'll be here." It was good to hear Mama call me Sha. That was the Creole term of affection. Sha was really the first part of the French word chérie. Sha meant what chérie means, dear one, loved one, or even little one. When I told a story about Opelousas and used the word Sha, I always had to explain that to my friends in North Carolina. I headed up Laurent Street, which ran alongside our house. I walked and noticed the way things had changed and hadn't changed. Mr. T. Garçon's house was still there, one block up on the left. That same fence around his front yard was still there. But Mr. T. Garçon had died a long time ago. I got a chill when I thought about him and his gators. I reached the next street, Jefferson, and took a left. Both sets of my grandparents had lived on this street. On my right was the pasture where we used to fly kites, play baseball. On my left, I was passing Miss Edmonia's house, which was right next door to Papa Rafael's house, my mother's father. Mama said Papa had always paid special attention to me. Even so many years after his death, I could see him standing tall on the porch of that white house with its tin roof. Thinking about Papa Rafael made me turn around and head back home. Back at our house, Mama was still moving around in the kitchen. In the living room, I was looking at those old albums that Mama had hung on to for us, she said. I was looking at Curtis Mayfield's 1972 Back to the World album when Daddy came back into the house with crawfish tails. "How was your travel?" Daddy and I were sitting and talking. "I almost didn't make it out of Raleigh, Daddy, with Hurricane Fran coming ashore." "Yeah, they were talking about that on the news. Your mama was starting to worry. I told her there was nothing to worry about. You know how to take care of yourself." "I know she worries, Daddy. She always has. I keep telling her, you've been a man a long time now." Daddy was sitting where he always sat, in his recliner right next to Mama's. The only thing that separated their recliners was a little red end table where the phone sat along with Mama's cards, her puzzle books, and the TV guide. Daddy was looking frail. That was something that was worrying Mama, but she wouldn't say anything to him because it wouldn't do any good. "Auguste, you need to eat better," she had said in the past. "I've been a man a long time now," would always be his reply. But Daddy's eating wasn't going to be a problem tonight. The smell of crawfish étouffée was all over the house. Sautéed onions, green peppers, and celery with tomatoes, garlic, and mushroom soup, and a cup of milk added, then the peeled crawfish tails and cayenne pepper. With all that cooking together, the aroma was so unbelievable, no true black Creole like my daddy was going to let this meal go by. My sister Eleanor and my brother's brother and Philip wouldn't be coming to this dinner. Eleanor was out of town, Brother was busy courting a new lady, and Philip lived in Memphis, Tennessee. Tonight, on my own, I would have to make sure Mama felt like she had done a good job on that etouffee. That call for seconds, if not thirds. I was ready for this important responsibility. "You better come on," Daddy called out from the kitchen. "Your mama says it's ready." Daddy ate well, and so did I. Mama was pleased. We went back into the living room. The two of them sat in their recliners. Me, I sat and then lay on the couch across the room from them. Daddy sneezed. "Show us the truth." I loved his sneeze, because when the sneeze part was over, he always added, "Show is the truth." It was all one thing, though. No hesitation, just a big, "Achoo, show is the truth." I had noticed it a long time ago. I loved to hear it now, because it just made me feel more at home. They were watching Jeopardy and talking to me. But after a while, they both drifted off to sleep right there in the living room, in their recliners. With a laugh, I always tell my friends that I go home to sit and watch my parents sleep. And in a way, I do. About 8:30, I woke them up to tell them I was going to bed. Long day, you know. I had to say that I was tired. If I hadn't done it this way, they both would have tried to stay up as long as I did, because their traveling son was home for a visit. That's just what they would do. I waited until I heard them get up and go to their room. Then I snuck back out to sit and listen to those Curtis Mayfield albums. Coming home always did have the feel of a move back in time. Tonight, though, listening to Curtis Mayfield, it seemed more than a feeling. I listened to the albums as I found them in the pile. Back to the World, 1976. Superfly, 1972. Then I picked up the 1965 People Get Ready album. That was the song and the year. The year of Hurricane Betsy. The year of the Seven. Back in the 60s, when my friends and I were in high school, Curtis Mayfield and the Impressions had been one of my favorite groups. We're a winner. Keep on pushing. People Get Ready. Those were all songs written by Curtis Mayfield, and Curtis Mayfield was the lead voice on those songs. A tenor, same as I was back then, Curtis Mayfield's voice was wispy, but given body by an echo that seemed to come from a deep cavern. Whether it was one of the old albums from the 60s or the new 1996 CD, listening to Curtis Mayfield always made me think about my high school friends, Ghost, Iron Horse, Soothsayer, Dolores, and Kool-Aid. We were together back in 1965, when everything was different, because for a time, Curtis Mayfield was dead. Chapter 3. The Manuscript. I jumped when I heard the knock on the door. Soothsayer got up and opened that door. With the same arm and hand gesture he had given to me, he directed a young man into his living room. Soothsayer returned to his seat in the big chair and pointed to the rocker. Now we were all sitting. For me, the quiet was as loud as gunfire. "I didn't think I was ever going to see you again, Mr. Robert." "You weren't supposed to. I would have preferred it that way. But I have so many questions I want to ask you. I don't have any answers, son." "I don't understand why you would say that. You wrote about it all. You must know everything." Dolores' son was holding an oversized brown manila envelope in his hand. I knew that in that envelope was the story of the Seven. The story I was somehow responsible for writing. The story I wasn't sure I had ever understood. "I know I should be able to help you. I know that, but I can't," I said. I sat forward. I looked into the eyes of Dolores' son. "Look," I said, "when I wrote all that, it was more like someone was dictating the story to me. It was like I was a recorder. Words, whole sentences, even whole paragraphs would come into my head, and I would write them down. When I looked back at what I had written, I didn't remember forming those sentences, let alone writing them down." "Maybe if you read it now, Robert, you could answer his questions," Soothsayer said. I didn't know what to say to that. I knew I didn't want to, because reading the manuscript would mean experiencing the story. I wasn't sure I could take that. Dolores' son got up from the rocker and put that big envelope next to me on the couch. My hesitation was obvious. I sat with my eyes closed, feeling like I was being attacked. "I think my mother would want you to try, Mr. Robert. I think that would be important to her." Unfair. It was unfair to bring Dolores into this moment. Bringing Dolores into it confused me. It was unfair. But it also softened me, touched me, brought her back to me. Soothsayer moved to the stereo and put on an album. Music I recognized. It was a moaning at first. In a humming, voices began to move through the room. I picked up the envelope, slipped the thick manuscript out, and put it in my lap. Soft, the music played, male voices humming. Then, that tenor, blending and leading, that deep in a cavern voice of Curtis Mayfield, that song, "People Get Ready." 35 years later, it was that song that called to me. Back then, it had called to all of us. And in that time, we had helped Curtis Mayfield survive dying. Some of us had survived too, but the song "People Get Ready" had not just survived, it had lived. Mr. Robert, you should know that, well, I believe the story. And I think as many people as possible should have a chance to know about what happened. Now I could hear those voices clear. "People Get Ready." "You believe?" "Why?" I asked. I could hear the voices saying, telling, that a train was coming. That's one of the reasons I want you to read it, so you can find out what I know. I have my own reasons that I'll explain after you've read the manuscript. It's not just the story. I could hear those voices saying, "Forget baggage. Just get on board." "So it's come that far. You believe?" "Well, yes, sir." I could hear those voices, that voice, saying that faith is all we need. "And you've learned more that makes you believe." My voice was close to a whisper, but at Soothsayer's little house, in the background was a melody of voices that were themselves a train coming, stopping here and there to let passengers get on board, and now was waiting for me. Dolores' son was rubbing his hands back and forth on the tops of his thighs. I must have been staring at him. He stopped moving altogether. "Faith is the key." I looked down at the first page of the manuscript. I began to read. Testimony. Already the memory is beginning to fade, yet when somehow you know that you have had a part in fixing a mistake in time, you know too that you can't let it fade. No doubt there must be something to learn from the course of events. So I write this feeling compelled to do so. Not sure what will come of this testimony, sure that few will believe, still certain that it must be recorded, so at least there is a chance for the lessons, whatever they are, to be passed on. I write then compelled by hope. Hope in the end was what pushed us on. Hope. We understood nothing else. September 1965. Everything seemed to change the night Curtis Mayfield was shot and killed on the stage of the Ed Sullivan Show. All of colored America had been waiting for this Sunday night in September. We had heard and been excited by the impression song "Keep On Pushing." We knew that some whites were really upset about that song. What a song! Telling colored people to keep pushing, keep fighting, don't give up. Now we were hearing about a new song, "People Get Ready," a song that some people said was telling us our time of freedom was near. And to get to see and hear the impressions do that song on television, on the Ed Sullivan Show, was something me and my brothers couldn't wait for. So, I couldn't believe it when just as they started to sing, "People Get Ready," a gunshot rang out, and Curtis Mayfield fell to his knees and then onto his face. Sad doesn't describe how I felt when, after a long station break, Ed Sullivan himself walked back onto his stage and said that Curtis Mayfield was dead. Days later, on the TV news, I watched the funeral with Brother and Philip, and we mourned the passing of a man whose songs had given colored people hope. But I felt guilty. Even as new as this was, I had the feeling that something even more important was going on. I tried to ignore that feeling, but somehow I knew something had been changed. I knew it, only I didn't know what or how. I just kept hearing a voice telling me that all of this wouldn't be happening if colored politicians hadn't lost the battle over the Wall Destruction Act of 1964. To myself, I said that there was a bright side to that failure. Who knows what would have happened if the Wall Destruction Act had been passed and the wall separating white and colored had come down. Riots, lynchings, stuff that Daddy said hadn't happened in a long time. That's why I thought, even if something more than the killing of Curtis Mayfield had happened and changed something, then the change might not be so bad. I mean, colored people were doing all right. We had our own places to live. We seldom saw white people. They didn't bother us because of the walls. Most of us never got close enough to see the walls anyway. Things weren't so bad. But that's what was giving me that funny feeling. Things aren't supposed to be all right for colored people. Not now, not yet, not this way. I had written this. I had signed it. That was my R at the end. Even back then, that was the R I signed everything with. Now I had to read the whole thing. Now I had to cross over into the past and relive the truth. And so sitting in Soothsayer's living room, with Dolores' son in arm's reach, I went back in time to when it all happened. I went back to the time of the walls. I crossed over the walls to witness the time of the storm, to witness the time of the 7th.